as we go, but we're going to have an opportunity afterwards to wrap up on questions. So if you think of things later on, then there'll be an opportunity then to deal with it. As is always, I suppose, the nature of an update, it's a little difficult to identify a particular theme about what's happened over the last year. What I've tried to do is pick up points that may be of interest over the last long year, so really going back to the end of last year. I want to start off with a few points on funding, and then I'll go on to deal with costs between the parties, and then Paul's going to pick up later on dealing with judicial reviews arising out of CARP judicial reviews and some particular issues that arise from those. So as I say, because there's no particular unifying theme, what I'm going to be doing is just running through a number of things that may feel a little disjointed, I'm sorry to say. But if we start off with funding on legal aid, some good news, I suppose, here. As you will probably know, the LASPO introduces an additional requirement if you're going to be included in the scope of legal aid, that the proceedings have to have the potential to produce a benefit for the individual or a member of their family or the environment. And FF concerned what the requirement of benefit was. The claimant was someone who was a Bahraini citizen who'd been granted... Yes, I'm sorry, yes, can you go to slide four, I think this is. Yes, the claimant was a Bahraini citizen who had been granted asylum, and he sought judicial review of a request that he'd made the Secretary of State, that a Bahraini prince who was alleged to have been involved in torture should be excluded from the UK. And his position was he was a pretty active campaigner, the legal agency refused funding on the basis that he didn't have or that the proceedings weren't apt to produce a benefit for him. And the judge set out a series of principles, which the main ones here are that it's a mixed question of law and fact, which where the idea of benefit's got to be given its ordinary broad meaning. And importantly, it's not something that was for a sort of irrationality judgment. Once the facts are known, then it was something for the court to decide whether the benefit was made out or not. And the judge said that it's something that goes beyond the very low threshold of a sufficient interest, but it doesn't need to go so far as to have a financial or material benefit. And in this case, he was prepared to hold that something that was psychological or involves the fulfillment of a moral obligation could be a sufficient benefit. And so in this case, the fact that the claimant was active in campaigning against the regime, that people who were close to him remained at risk, and he felt he had a moral duty to those people who relied on him, was sufficient, particularly given that he himself had provided a dossier of material in support of his request. And taking all those factors together, that meant that he stood outside the class of someone who was just an interested peace campaigner. There was an earlier case of Evans, which was said to be distinguishable, and he had a sufficient benefit. So it's something that may be of value going forward. So that's legal aid. I want to move on to the next slide now, which is Quarks, just where we've ended up on this. As you'll probably be aware, in the review on fixed recoverable costs, Sir Rupert Jackson recommended a modified R-House and costs budgeting for what he described as heavy claims, which he thought would be ones that would last more than 2 days or have £100,000 costs. In its review on part two of LASPO, the government said that they needed more information about that. But in their consultation on fixed recoverable costs in March 2019, they made pretty clear that they weren't going to introduce Quarks into public law cases, largely because they didn't think there was a problem. They thought that because you could get cost-capping orders, And because legal aid was available, there wasn't a problem with access to justice, they said, so they weren't going to increase quacks, apply quacks to judicial reviews at all. Although they did think that it would be interesting, that they were interested in exploring, introducing cost budgeting for claims where costs were, for one side or another, were going to be more than £100,000. So that appears to have drawn a line under the current movement towards introducing quacks in public law cases of people who, as a second best, it may be worth introducing cost budgeting. We may have some discussion about that after these presentations. The latest development in this is a case called Leighton and the Lord Chancellor, where there was a challenge to the corresponding failure to extend quacks to discrimination claims. And there, the Lord Chancellor defended partly on the basis that they hadn't yet made a decision to that effect, and also on the basis that in any event, it wasn't unlawful not to extend quacks as matters stand. And they succeeded on that second point. And so in that area, it looks like the point is potentially still under consideration. So if we then come on to cost capping, just remind ourselves of what the provisions are currently. Criminal Justice and Courts Act, you can only get an order if, among other things, the proceedings are public interest proceedings, the claimant's going to withdraw if they don't get protection, and they'll be acting reasonably in withdrawing. And then there are limitations about what are public interest proceedings. It's got to be, if we go on to the next slide, in deciding that, you've got to decide on the number of people that are directly affected, how significant the effect's going to be, and whether the proceedings involve a consideration of point of law of general public importance. And that's been considered fairly recently in a case called We Love Hackney Limited. That was a case where Hackney made a decision to restrict the number of nighttime alcohol licenses that they were going to allow in some areas, in particular in Shoreditch and Dalston. And We Love Hackney was a company that was said to be an organisation made up of local residents and business owners. And they brought a challenge based on public sector equality duty and on the decision-making process. And they applied for for cost protection. Justice Farby rejected the application, saying that it wasn't a matter of public importance, because the decision only related to Hackney. That wasn't about the number of people in Hackney. It was simply that it didn't have any wider implications for licensing law more generally. And although it was a PSED challenge in connection with licensing, principles were well known, and there was no general public law point there. On the question about the number of people affected, the judge said that although there were a number of people who were affected, they weren't directly affected. And what she said was that phrase wasn't apt to include anyone who works in licensed premises or who goes for a late night drink or who wishes at some stage in the future to invest in licensable activities in Hackney. And therefore, you simply didn't get past requirement that there was direct effect there, let alone having to consider what the nature of the effect was. That's perhaps a slightly problematic type of reasoning, because although it may not be the most serious impact, the nature of the application was about licensing. So if you ask, well, how does that subject matter of the dispute impact on people, it's obviously direct. If you can't take advantage of the very thing that you're challenging, and it may well be that the point is better analysed as the nature of the effect, but this can perhaps create problems in future cases when similar classes are affected in a way which doesn't have a direct and substantial impact on their lives, but nonetheless does involve taking away the very thing that they're complaining about. But it may well be that part of the reasoning behind this was to do with the nature of the application being made. And if we go on to the next slide, we can see that this is a case where satisfied that the company would withdraw if the claim wasn't, if they didn't get cost protection. She held that wasn't reasonable because there were well-resourced directors and backers, and there's various sections of the judgment that talk about the directors and the people who are supporting the company. Were by and large people who were involved in the licensing trade in Hackney, and the judge took the view that they'd have been well able to stand in if protection wasn't given. And what was important, though, was she went further than that, because Hackney didn't only resist the application for the cost-capping order, they also made their own application for security for costs, which they're allowed to do because you can apply for security against a company that doesn't have the money to pay the costs if they lose. And really that operated back to back. The company couldn't on the one hand say, well, we don't have enough money to run the claim. And on the other hand say, well, don't make an order for security of costs. And so security was ordered. And there's really two points come out of that. One is that it's not something that's normally applied for. In judicial review claims, but one can see that there's potential to do so when a claimant is a company. Orders for security costs aren't normally available against individuals, but they are available against people who are nominal claimants. And it's not clear what the position would be if you chose someone to front a judicial review claim on the basis that they didn't have funds. And whether there would be potential to make an application for security against them. The other interesting point is the amount that the judge ordered, because Hackney said they'd spent £55,000 up to that stage, which was pretty much front-loading the claim. And they then sought security for just over £106,000, which they said was the total amount that they were going to spend. And the judge only ordered security in the sum of £60,000. So she was only prepared to award, assume that £5,000 was going to be sufficient to cover skeleton arguments and everything else to the trial, which perhaps gives a helpful insight into the sort of figures that might be awarded. So I can then go on to the next slide. And this is, again, it's a procedural point, but an important one, which was you've got it's Harvey and Leighton, which is a case of someone who, as an individual, brought a challenge to a decision about market traders. She, at the time, application. And the defendants then applied to set aside the order. And there's really two points come from it. One was that the judge, and the good news is that the judge rejected the proposition that there was a general power to look again at a cost-capping order once the hearing had come to an end. He held that the whole point about a cost-capping order is it gives you some certainty as to what sort of costs you're going to have to pay. But the downside of that was that he did make an application that he accepted the application to vary the order on the basis there had been a failure to disclose. And so poor Miss Harvey found herself thinking when going into the hearing that she had a cost capping order of £4,000, but when she came out of the hearing, the order had been varied to £20,000 on the basis of her failure to disclose. Because the judge found that some different order would have been made if she had disclosed it, and that was the best they could do to decide what that order would have been. So that's cost-capping orders. Can we move on? There's the next slide I won't deal with. That just deals with some points about what the effect of the cost-capping order is when partial orders of costs are made. And then if I can just go on to the next slide, which is cost in private litigation, CCMs in private litigation. This is one of those areas where you sometimes feel the courts are taking a bit of a wrong turn. What's happened is that they've held that cost-capping orders or their equivalent simply aren't available at all in private litigation. So, for example, in Mourne, that's Joyne and Mourne, the Good Law Project, took an Uber ride and suspecting that they weren't paying their taxes on it, asked for a VAT receipt. And then when he didn't get one, applied for a declaration of Chancery. Basically, couldn't get one because of feelings. They held rather confusing that the court's got jurisdiction to make it, but the case laws do so in standard private litigation. The difficulty with all this is that very often public law principles get developed in private litigation. Cases for false imprisonment are an obvious example, and other cases for trespass. And it's a little difficult to see where the boundary should be drawn. So this is perhaps an area to watch when public law issues are being litigated in other proceedings. We then move on to costs between the parties. And the main point, the first point I want to pick up is where you've got multiple parties who are represented at the permission stage. As you probably know, that in a substantive hearing, when someone loses, when a claimant loses, defendants will normally only have one set of costs awarded in their favour on the basis that that one person ought to represent everybody else. And this case seems to establish that, the CPRE case seems to establish that that doesn't apply at the permission stage. These are planning proceedings, but there's no reason why it shouldn't apply more generally. And so the permission, the position is summarised, paragraph 37, that when permission to seek review is refused, then the claimant can be liable for the costs of more than one defendant and or interested parties. They don't have to show exceptional circumstances, and the only control really is proportionality, so that if there's one party who obviously ought to take the lead and the other parties don't add to what they say, then only one set of costs may still be recoverable. So the lesson really is the claimants take especial care about how many defendants or interested parties you're joining, because you may be just multiplying your costs liability if you don't get permission. And for defendants, cooperate when you put in your acknowledgement of service, because otherwise you might not get your costs because you're thought to be duplicative. So what you want to do is divide up the points that you're going to take. Can we then move on to the next slide? And this is where there perhaps have been some important developments where there's no substantive hearing. Just so to recap, M and Croydon divided cases into three broad categories. One where a claimant's been wholly successful, in which case they would get their costs, where they've succeeded only in part, or where there's been some compromise which doesn't actually reflect the claimant's claim. And where what has been the cases that have followed in the last year really have been ones that have focused on the first of those points, where the claimant's been wholly successful. And the first one, most recent in time, is a case called Parveen and Redbridge. And that was a case where it was a housing case where the claimant was temporarily housed in a hostel and brought proceedings saying that's not suitable accommodation. And a month before the hearing, the authority offered self-contained accommodation that was suitable after they'd been provided with a medical report, which really confirmed what the claimant said she'd been saying all along. And the judge refused to order costs and ordered that both sides should bear their own costs on the basis that it wasn't possible to decide what the causal connection was between the claim for judicial review and the offer that was eventually made. And so the court summarised the principles. First of all, they rejected a point made by the defendant that where you withdraw, then the claimant ought prima facie to pay the costs. They said that didn't apply. You had to go straight to the M and Croydon principles. So what you want to ask is, first of all, is the claimant a successful party? In this case, yes, they were, because they got the order they wanted. And if so, though, you have to go on and ask if that success is caused by the proceedings. And if not, then you've got to have sufficient confidence the claimant would have won anyway. And the significant point, really, and the real sting in the case, is the court spends a lot of time saying that investigating those issues has got to be proportionate. And so although they when you read between the lines of the judgment, it looks like they might have been inclined to find that the offer had been made as a result of the proceedings. They said, well, without a fuller investigation. And there's a real risk here that we're going to get back to the position we were in before Butter, where authorities kept saying, oh, well, we had other reasons for settling the claim and therefore you shouldn't have your costs. And this really is the updated version of that, where defendants are saying, well, you got what you wanted, but we had other reasons for doing it because we were going to do it anyway, or events overtook us, and therefore you don't have your case. Your relief hasn't been linked to the proceedings you brought. And it's something that's really going to have to be pushed, because otherwise it's going to be all too easy for defendants to muddy the waters a bit and then say, well, you can't show causation. So we'll see what happens following Darwin in this very recent case. Next slide, please, is just an illustration of how difficult it can be sometimes to decide who is the successful party. Patel and Gandhi was a case where the claimants sought orders that they hadn't used deception. It's one of those the English language test cases. And in the alternative, they said, well, we ought to have a right to deal with that on appeal. And they won on the second point, lost on the first point. And the court said, well, overall, we can't say who's won, and therefore no order of cost was made. And again, the practice lesson here really is be careful what you plead and don't overplead cases. And if there is a theme that comes through these cases, it's that people who overload claims end up being less successful in costs orders. Then if you go on the next slide, Osman is another case of a settlement where just because you settle the case and just because you win doesn't immunize you from being scrutinized about whether you've acted reasonably. There, they hadn't acted reasonably and they had their costs reduced. Then we've got the next slide. Midway Soft Drinks is an interesting case where it follows on from a scheme that was introduced by the Revenue to approve people for wholesale alcohol licenses. And they could only grant you approval if they were satisfied you were fit and proper. And there are a series of cases where they decided people weren't fit and proper. And the problem arose that gave a right of appeal, but no right to give interim approval or a stay pending the appeal. And so a series of companies said, well, we're going to go out of business, and they therefore brought proceedings saying we want an injunction. And that's what happened in this case. They were granted an interim injunction, and then by the time the hearing had come about, the substantive issue had been resolved, which is all about underlying payment. And therefore, they said, well, it's become academic, but we have succeeded in our claim. And the Court of Appeal held that this is a case where they ought to get their costs because they said, well, this is a new scheme. You could see this coming. These kind of applications would be made. And also, because there's lots of things going on in the background, you could see that they would become academic before they got finally resolved. And then they said their claimants had to start the JR proceedings in order to have any chance of obtaining interim protection. And therefore they got their costs. Now the difficulty with that is you have to get around an earlier case, which is a case called RL and Croydon, which is one that was applied in Parveen, where you have more or less exactly the same scenario. Because in that case, you had a case where an assessment was being made of someone with no recourse to public funds. They wanted their accommodation before then. And they got it but on an interim order, but then by the time the hearing came around, the events had taken their course, and they lost their costs on the basis that there was no causation. And the only distinction that the court could produce was that there's a difference between potentially going out of business and not having accommodation. And it's a little difficult to work out what the distinction in principle there is. And again, it's one of those cases where sooner or later this is going to have to be confronted and potentially with a case where there is a a pressing need for accommodation where if you don't get it, then the entire benefit of what you're seeking might be lost. So an analogy with make-weight drinks. But again, it's a conflict to explore. Then there's a slide here just about various cases on partial success, where courts have adjusted costs orders. The lessons that you need to get here again is don't overload the claim. You're going to be much better off if it's a point where a permission has been granted. But the general rule of thumb seems to be that where there's been failure on a substantial ground, then you may get your full costs, but very often the court will reduce something like 20 to 25% of the costs. Then if I can just go on to deal with one on the next slide, which is Rakib and Barts Health Trust, which is a case where under the any difference rule, the claimant won on the point of law, because this case of someone who the trust didn't want her to travel to Italy to receive treatment, and they hadn't considered her EU right to receive services in the member state. But if they had considered it, then they would have made the same decision. So they were refused relief on that basis, but nonetheless, they got their costs, despite the fact that, well, that there was some reduction because of a failure on a different point, but that doesn't affect the principle here. So that's the discretion on no relief. Then there's finally just a point on particular parties. The only point I really want to pick up here is a point about the rule that where a judicial body is being challenged, they don't actively contest the proceedings, they don't normally have costs ordered against them. That was applied in a case called DPK and Lord Chancellor, although in that case costs were ordered because the defendant did step into the ring, to use the language of the judge. It was a case where they made a practice direction that cases with a particular firm of solicitors shouldn't be heard in Birmingham because two of their directors had been made fee-paying judges there. And that was challenged successfully and then vigorously defended by the Lord Chancellor, who then had to pay the costs. But what the court did was follow principles that have been laid down in a case called Davis and then also Gourlay and Parole Board. And the important point is that Gourlay is going to the Supreme Court, where we expect them to address that rule more generally, but also it may be an opportunity for the court to look at how relevant it is that someone is legally aided, because one of the arguments going to be made will be to the effect that if you're legally aided, then cost rules ought not to be arranged in such a way that you don't get your costs if you win. So that's one to watch. And that, I think, also links in to what Paul is going to say, who's going to follow now. I'm going to stop there.
Thanks very much, Martin. Can everyone hear me now? I
don't know. Paul, shall I just introduce you, as that's what I'm here for?
Thanks very much.
Just to say, welcome, Paul, and thank you, Martin. That was a very interesting talk. And I think there's no sort of questions that I can see, apart from somebody saying hello. So we'll deal with questions at the end of both sessions. Welcome, Paul, who's also at Doughty Street Chambers. Paul specialises in immigration and a lot of public law cases around that. He has dealt with many of the leading cases on immigration or against the Home Office. And he's recently represented a claimant challenging a court fee charged by the Liverpool County Court during a low-value personal injury claim, which had been overcharged by 50%, and that was useful for very many other claimants. So thank you very much, Paul, for coming and talking to us here, and I'll just let you kick off now. And as before, if anyone's got any questions while Paul's talking, then do put them on the chat. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Polly. Thanks for everyone else joining us this afternoon. Thank you to Martin for an encyclopedic survey of cost law relating to judicial review claims. My talk is going to be substantially narrower in that I'm going to be dealing with a single category of judicial review claim known as the CART judicial review claims, which is concerned with challenging the upper tribunal's refusal of permission to appeal on behalf of a client who's seeking to challenge an adverse first-tier tribunal determination. And this is an issue which certainly I've been grappling with for quite a few years now. And Martin and myself will have an opportunity, obviously, to try and persuade the Court of Appeal in a case of JH, which I'll go into in greater detail in a moment, which I think is listed for hearing, I think, on the 24th of June. So we're not sure in what capacity it will come on at the moment, but that's the plan. So, Polly, if I could perhaps go to the first slide, maybe just have a quick look at my brief resume of CPR 54.7A. This is the relevant civil procedure rule. Maybe if I just go to the second slide. Thank you very much. This is the rule which we have to work with for CART judicial review claims. In comparison, obviously, with other parts of the CPR, it's pretty much bare bones. It came into being as a result of the Supreme Court's judgment in CART, where the Supreme Court was obviously concerned involving asylum claims, protection-based claims, that there was no seemingly remedy available to individuals, despite the requirement of anxious scrutiny, the fact that individuals are at risk of being returned to countries where they're going to be at risk of torture or death. So the CART judicial review remedy was fashioned, which then ultimately became CPR 54.7A. It's a fairly narrow remedy. The only way in which the upper tribunal's refusal of permission to appeal can be challenged is through the application of the second appeal test, which is obviously a very high threshold. If permission is granted as well within the CPR rule, and this obviously has a relevance to the issue of costs, if permission is granted on the papers, you're not allowed an oral renewal hearing in respect to such claims. Then the refusal of permission to appeal by the upper tribunal will be quashed on the papers unless either the upper tribunal or the interested party, which of course in immigration cases will be Secretary of State for the Home Department, requests a full hearing within 14 days. Now, I've been involved in obviously numerous CART judicial review claims, and I've never yet had a request by the Secretary of State for a full hearing. So generally, the grant of permission is in the vast majority of cases decisive in respect of a CART judicial review. And also, unless there is some overriding point of principle involved, the upper tribunal does not play a part. I mean, they have no involvement in the case whatsoever and just let the Secretary of State obviously fight their corner. The other issue as well, which is obviously real importance, is that as far as I can see, there is no clue as to what costs order should follow within the Supreme Court's judgment in CART, nor is there any indication within CPR 54.7A as to what the appropriate cost order should be in respect of a successful claim. I would, of course, argue that that means that the usual cost rules should apply, namely that if a CART judicial review claim is successful, a grant of costs for the successful claimant should follow. However, as we can see shortly, the situation has regrettably been a great deal more complicated than that. So, Polly, if we just go to the second slide. And this is, regrettably, the guideline case on costs for CART judicial review claims, the case of Fakiri. I was certainly involved in some skirmishing before the Court of Appeal on respect of the administrative court's failure to award costs in respect of a successful CART judicial review claim a good few years back, in which we were granted permission by Lord Justice Underhill. The matter was heading for a hearing, and then the Secretary of State conceded the matter by agreeing to pay our costs for the CART judicial review claim. But obviously that didn't result in a guideline judgment. I suspect the Secretary of State did that in quite a few cases, but then decided to take a more bullish approach to the issue of costs, which then resulted in costs being fought across the board by the Secretary of State, and then ultimately led to this test case of Fakiri and the Court of Appeals judgment. Now, the facts of Fakiri are that it is a legal aided claimant whose asylum claims had been rejected by the first tier tribunal. They then applied for permission to appeal by the upper tribunal. That was refused. A cart judicial review claim was then lodged before the administrative court, and it succeeded with the claimant being granted permission by the administrative court. And the upper tribunal, as already stated, playing no part in the proceedings, and the Secretary of State, as interested party, not lodging an acknowledgement of service. And then when the claim succeeded, opposing the issue of costs because they were a party who had not previously been involved in the proceedings. Now, before we reached that point, the Secretary of State's practice was to lodge a pro forma letter with the court, and this is pretty much what the letter says. In this case, my instructions are not to lodge an AOS. This is because the law in this area is settled by the case of Cart. If the court takes the view that it would be assisted by a detailed response, I therefore reserve the right to lodge one at a future date. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think that is the Secretary of State obviously playing no role in these proceedings. The letter is kind of a holding position. And frequently you do get judges on the papers saying, well, I'm not going to make a permission decision. I'm going to ask the Secretary of State to lodge a summary grounds, at which point the Secretary of State lodges summary grounds. But the Secretary of State's practice was to lodge these letters. And then if permission was granted subsequently, to then say, well, we haven't had any active involvement in this case, therefore you can't make a cost order against ourselves. Well, in Fakiri, somewhat curiously, the administrative court judge didn't make no order for costs, but instead made an order remitting the issue of costs of the judicial review proceedings, the CART judicial review proceedings, to the upper tribunal for determination as part of the claimant's statutory appeal. And presumably the first tier tribunal, if the matter was remitted to the first tier tribunal. Well, the claimant appealed to the Court of Appeal and advanced a number of arguments in Fakiri. Firstly, that the upper tribunal should have been responsible for his costs for the successful case. Well, I'm not going to get into that, but Martin certainly touched on this issue in the course of his talk, namely that there is some quite restrictive case law, namely that of Davies, which prevents cost orders being made against defendant tribunals unless it falls within certain fairly clearly delineated scenarios. I mean, just for the sake of clarity, anyway, on this, paragraph 22 of Fakiri, Lord Justice Hickinbottom goes through the scenarios. They're normally where there was a flagrant instance of improper behaviour, or when the consent order disposing of where the inferior court or tribunal unreasonably declined or neglected to sign a consent order disposing of the proceedings. So, I mean, it's something, it's some sort of conduct on the part of the tribunal which is deserving of some sort of clear judicial disapproval. Well, the Court of Appeal in Fakiri said none of that was in play in that case. And therefore then went on to say the fact that the claimant in Fakiri was legally aided was not a reason to go behind Davies, nor was the Supreme Court's judgment in unison about right of access to a court sufficient to go behind Davies. So Davies was upheld, as indeed it was, obviously, as Martin's just said, in the earlier Court of Appeal case of Gourley, which is obviously now on its way to the Supreme Court. So that part of the challenge in Fakiri failed. But just moving on to the part of the grounds of appeal, which obviously concern our future case of JH, the Court of Appeal accepted that a cost order could be made against an interested party. Maybe Polly might be worth just moving on to the next slide, actually, just where we go. Yeah, thanks, Sue. Could be made against an interested party who had intentionally played no part in the proceedings, particularly as the real protagonists within the claim were the claimant and the Home Office, because the Home Office had made the original decision refusing the claimant's application for international protection and therefore precipitated the subsequent judicial review claim, not least because they continued to oppose the claimant's underlying claim to refugee status. So one might expect, having read the Court of Appeal's guidance on this issue, that that could well mean that the appeal in Fakiri would be allowed. But no. Just moving on to the next slide, Lord Justice Hickinbottom obviously rejected the appeal on the basis at 55 to 57 of Fakiri that the Administrative Court's cost order was open to it, fell within the legitimate scope of lawful costs open order open to the court. What's even more alarming about this is obviously the fact that the claimant is legally aided, and we'll come on to obviously the legal aid situation obviously and the principles relating to that in a moment. But what the Court of Appeal also, which is a matter of real concern, recognised that the effect of the said order was to effectively deny the successful claimant his costs unless he could establish before the upper tribunal or the first tier tribunal that the Home Office had acted improperly for the purposes of Rule 10 of the Tribunal Procedure, Upper Tribunal Rules 2008. And we'll come back to this rule in a moment. But essentially, the costs jurisdiction of the tribunals are very similar to those we find before other tribunals, such as employment tribunals, that cost orders are the exception. Costs do not follow the event, obviously, before these tribunals. And instead, what one needs to establish is something close to a sort of a wasted costs order. Open to the Administrative Court, and that the claimants. Sorry, Polly, can everyone hear me still? Oh, God. Hello, can everyone still hear me?
Yes, Paul, we
can. Okay, great. Firstly, there was a concession that the remittal of the issue of costs to the Upper Tribunal was jurisdictionally open to the Administrative Court by both parties' counsel. For the claimant and for the Home Office, and that the claimant's protection and human rights appeal had also, after being remitted back to the Upper Tribunal and then being remitted again back to the First Tier Tribunal, had ultimately been lawfully dismissed by the First Tier Tribunal, and that there was no appeal pending against it, meaning that his overall claim failed. I mean, this is also a somewhat sort of controversial factor which the Court of Appeal obviously plainly attached weight to, because this obviously hadn't happened at the time of the Administrative Court's remittal to the Upper Tribunal. So that's where the law stands at present, courtesy of the Court of Appeal's judgment in Fakiri, which brings us obviously on to Martin and myself's case of JH Palestinian Territories. The client is a gentleman who comes from Gaza. Gaza raises all kinds of very knotty, complex legal issues concerning international humanitarian law, the fact that Israel, as recognised by the International Court of Justice, is an occupying power over, obviously, the Palestinian territories. And one of the issues arising from JH was, what are the legal consequences if the client was able to enter Egypt, travel to the Rafah crossing, but because he wasn't recognised as having an appropriate registration number, obviously, by the Israeli authorities, would not be allowed to cross the Rafah crossing into his home territory. So this has been grappled with by a number of tribunals and courts, which probably is still yet to really receive a comprehensive judgment. But the appellant in JH was partially successful before the First Tier Tribunal, who granted him humanitarian protection, but rejected his case insofar as it related to the crossing into Rafah, and also rejected his case that he was a refugee. Both parties, both the Home Office appealed against the grant of humanitarian protection. I, on behalf of the appellant, appealed against the dismissal of his refugee claim, and also appealed against the refusal of all of his claims concerning the prospect of him being refused entry across the Rafah crossing into Gaza. The first tier tribunal partially granted permission to appeal to both parties. I then renewed my application for permission to appeal to the upper tribunal, who then rejected my application across the board. I then took a CART judicial review claim to the administrative court, who in a strange judgment or strange decision refused me permission on the papers, which meant I then had to go to the Court of Appeal and renew my application for permission for the CART judicial review claim. Luckily or unluckily, I drew Lord Justice Sales on the papers, but fortunately just before the Christmas holiday, when he was probably in an unusually good mood, who then granted me permission and remitted the matter, and in the relevant order seemed to be with the view that this matter should perhaps go straight back to the administrative court for a substantive hearing. However, the matter went back to the administrative court. Neither the Secretary of State or the upper tribunal requested a full hearing. So therefore, a circuit judge with probably not a great deal of judicial review experience quashed the decision pursuant to CPR 54.7a, but made an order entirely silent on the issue of costs, didn't even grant us detailed assessment for the purposes of legal aid. We then applied to vary this order, and it ended up in front of a High Court judge, but someone who doesn't generally do public law work, who did grant us detailed assessment for the purposes of public funding, but then made no order for cost following the Secretary of State's submissions because they hadn't lodged an acknowledgement of service and had played no active role in the case. Well, I mean, you can imagine obviously how my instructing solicitors and I felt. I mean, we'd been involved. It incurred a lot of work going to the administrative court for the CART judicial review claim, and then obviously appealed to the Court of Appeal. Again, a great deal of work involved in that, then involved in cost submissions before the administrative court, only to obviously just receive and ultimately be entirely successful for reasons obviously as contained within our detailed statement of grounds, but no order for a cost in our favour, obviously on the orders of two separate judges. So the matter then went to the Court of Appeal. As I've said already, a hearing is pending, and one would imagine that that this time the Court of Appeal will have to grapple with the following issues, which regrettably both Martin and I say were not properly thought about and considered in the case of Fakiri. I mean, obviously a great deal more costs is at stake in JH than Fakiri, and also ultimately after the refusal of permission to appeal was quashed, the matter went back to the upper tribunal. There was a hearing before a presidential panel, and the Secretary of State decided to withdraw their appeal against the first tier tribunal's grant of humanitarian protection. And as a result, the claimant decided, well, it wasn't worth the candle to pursue his appeal simply on refugee status. So unlike Fakiri, we can say that this appeal was largely successful because our client, contrary to the Secretary of State's original adverse decision, was granted humanitarian protection. So anyway, if I quickly go through perhaps some of the arguments which Martin and I will hopefully be trying to persuade the courts with. I mean, one of the issues, and I suspect that this will be quite similar to what the... Sorry, thanks, Polly. But just move on to the legally assisted claimants. Thank you very much. And I suspect this will be quite similar to some of the arguments which are going to be before the Supreme Court in the case of Gourlay. But although there is obviously a welcome line of authority which stretches back a number of years, that the availability of legal aid practitioners is a relevant factor in deciding what order should be made, and also taken into account in deciding whether or not a claimant should be regarded as successful or not. I mean, from my reading of many of the authorities, I'm not sure that the stark and quite staggering extent of cuts in legal aid has really been grappled with, obviously, by the Court of Appeal. perhaps if just focus on a couple of the cuts, which obviously probably most people will obviously be more than aware of. But in particular, the 2nd of December 2013 cut, Schedule 1 of the Civil Legal Aid Remuneration Amendment Regulations 2013. I mean, this cut the hourly rate for counsel over 10 years' call outside London for administrative court and upper tribunal judicial reviews by 50%. I mean, I think it was in the region of something like £112 to £67.50. In addition to obviously the fact that claims are now at risk prior to a grant of permission, unless they fall within certain fairly narrow sets of circumstances. I mean, what we hope in JH will occur, if we just move to the next legally assisted claimants slide, Polly. Thank you very much. We hope that the Court of Appeal will adopt and follow the propositions accepted at 92 to 93 and 106 of ZN Afghanistan. And these are put in slightly different ways by Lord Justice Singh and Sir Brian Levinson. But I mean, ultimately, it's just simply, this is a material consideration that if you have a claimant who has been successful for grounds which are contained within their detailed statement of grounds rather than some other external factor, the importance of ensuring that legal aid practitioners are adequately remunerated must be a material consideration as to whether or not costs should be awarded. And maybe the court doesn't quite go as far to say that this should be the norm or that one would expect in those circumstances that costs should be awarded. It would obviously be refreshing if in JH the court would take that step and perhaps make an issue an even stronger dictum, although for all of the cases that Martin's obviously referred to in the course of his talk, the court seems to be travelling in different directions, or certain law justices appear to be travelling in different directions to others. The next issue as well, which we hope the Court of Appeal will attach some weight to, is that, and this Marla Martin's previous case of Ben Hall Bell, which was obviously challenging a sort of systemic challenge to the withdrawal of legal aid granted permission. But at 69 of Ben Hall Bell, obviously noted with concern already in 2015, the 23% decline in applications for legal aid since the cuts had come into effect and the need for a review of the same, which I understand was accepted by Treasury Council. What we will ask the Court of Appeal to take into account is the Ministry of Justice statistics quarterlies. Steady fall in judicial review claims being commenced from 2014 to 2019. And if Paul, if you just turn to the next slide, you can see a snapshot of what these quarterlies confirm. Again, this is probably immediately prior to the Ben Hall Bell case, but July to September 2014, in 2013, there were 13,130 claims commenced, although during the period from January to September 2014, only 3,059 were issued, although obviously it's important to recognise that some of the shortfall would have been issued in the upper tribunal. But then if we look at the quarterly for July to September 2018, we're down to 2,700 claims being issued, with immigration and asylum claims being down 21% and civil claims down 10% in comparison with the previous year. And then July to September 2019, during the period from January to September 2019, only 2,600 claims were issued, with immigration and asylum claims being down 5% and civil claims down 2% in comparison with the previous year. So these statistics show that the legal aid cuts are having a undoubted chilling effect on the ability of legal aid practitioners to do their work and properly represent their clients, which begs the question, well, what happens to individuals who obviously cannot find their way to someone with the appropriate legal aid contract? Either the claims are never made, or presumably they're being not advised that they have a legal aid entitlement, and individuals are trying to do things privately, but you shudder to think with what consequences. But if we just move to the next slide, this is an issue which obviously certainly wasn't grappled with at all in the course of Fakiri, is that, and it's really, I mean, what essentially we're trying to do here is to turn the Secretary of State's main submission against them I mean, their argument is, well, we didn't lodge an acknowledgement of service, and as a result, we shouldn't have to bear the costs. But our argument is, well, if one works out and understands why, when Lord Wolfe, as the work was carried on subsequently by Lord Justice Jackson, why was the CPR brought into effect? The whole basis, the rationale for the CPR is to reduce costs and make litigation more efficient. And yet in the present case, in JH, in order to get permission, I had to go all the way to the Court of Appeal and be granted on the papers, but permission by the papers by Lord Justice. I mean, and bearing in mind that when the case came back, the Secretary of State did not request a substantive hearing. The argument is, well, isn't this an evidence that the system is breaking down? If the Secretary of State had lodged an acknowledgement of service, it would have forced them to have grappled with the relevant legal issues. And that may have been instructive because it would have obviously forced them to consider whether or not they should have just conceded the case at that time. Under the CPR, CPR 1.1 and 1.3, this is the overriding obligation and the party's obligation to help the court in furthering the overriding. And the overriding objective, of course, means that parties comply with CPR rules and assist with dealing with a case at a proportionate cost. And there is quite a long line of authority that if a party acts in breach of CPR 1.1, chiefly because they do not assist in identifying the appropriate issues, perhaps not responding to correspondence, taking a neutral position, that can be taken into account when considering costs. Now, the first authority which I've set out here is Ford versus GKR Construction Limited from 2000. This is a judgment of Lord Wolfe, or Lord Justice Wolfe as he then was, Lord Justice Judge as he then was. And what they say is that as part of the CPR, if the CPR rule does not contain this, the CPR rules must be construed in light of the procedural requirements as set out within the relevant pre-action protocols. Well, certainly the pre-action protocol for judicial review claims, which was in operation, and my understanding is it hasn't materially changed since, certainly at the time when our part judicial review claim was initially lodged, provides at 3 and 7 that the aims of the protocol are to enable parties, prospective claims, to understand and properly identify the issues in dispute in the proposed claim and share information and relevant documents. C, try to settle the dispute without proceedings or reduce the issues in dispute. D, avoid unnecessary expense and keep down the cost of resolving the dispute and support the efficient management of proceedings where litigation cannot be avoided. And where the use of the protocol is appropriate, the court will normally expect all parties to have a good time before proceedings are issued and will take into account compliance or non-compliance when giving directions for case management of proceedings or when making orders for costs. Well, I mean, following on from of other authorities such as Hallam Estates and Davies, I mean, our core argument on this is that particularly in a case involving asylum issues, a case which is supposed to be deserving of anxious scrutiny, it's incumbent upon the Secretary of State to lodge an AOS and in order to assist both the claimant and the court. And it's certainly, obviously, even under the CPR, if a party fails to lodge an AOS but then takes part in a substantive hearing of a claim, this will have cost consequences. So our argument in JH is, well, if they fail to lodge an AOS in a CART judicial review, especially as generally the procedure leading up to a decision on permission will be determinative, it ought to have cost consequences in that scenario as well. Finally, and I'm going to tread carefully here because this is obviously Martin's argument, and I can't take a great deal of credit for this at all anyway, but finally, can the administrative court lawfully remit the issue of cost to the upper tribunal? Now, this really is fresh territory for the Court of Appeal because you may recall, obviously, earlier in the talk in Fakiri, both counsel for the claimant and also for the Secretary of State jointly agreed that it was open to the administrative court to remit the issue of costs to the upper tribunal, notwithstanding the staggeringly different cost regime before both forums. I think I've touched on this. Indeed, alarmingly, the Court of Appeal more or less accepted this, that Rule 10.3 of the Tribunal Procedure, Upper Tribunal Rules 2008, prevents an award of costs occurring unless someone's acted unreasonably in bringing, defending, or conducting the proceedings. And probably the guideline upper tribunal determination of this is Thapper and others, in which the upper tribunal was quite clear that these cost powers are to be exercised with significant restraint and of a fundamental different character from those under the CPR, where costs will regularly follow the event. However, right, I mean, this is, if we move to the final slide, Polly, thanks. The issue is, does the administrative court even have jurisdiction to remit the issue of costs to the upper tribunal? Because the statutory powers relating to costs orders for both the first tier tribunal and the upper tribunal is section 29 of the Tribunals, Courts and Enforcement Act 2007. And this provides the costs of an incidental to A, all proceedings in the first tier tribunal, and B, all proceedings in the upper tribunal shall be in the discretion of the tribunal in which the proceedings take place. Well, I mean, our argument in JH is that the only costs which are open to be awarded by the upper tribunal and the first tier tribunal are costs relating to proceedings before the tribunal, that an order from the administrative court cannot clothe the upper tribunal or the first tier tribunal with the power to award costs in respect of proceedings before a senior court. And the argument is that section 29 wording is not materially different from that contained within section 51 of the Senior Courts Act 1981. You haven't got the wording of that, but I mean, perhaps if I just paraphrase section 51, what it does is sort of roll up the cost jurisdiction of the following courts: court, Civil Division of the Court of Appeal, High Court, the Family Court, and the County Court. So the cost of an incidental to all proceedings in those particular courts shall be in the discretion of the court. However, I mean, it's important to note that there is a caveat even in respect of section 51, that within following 42 to 47 of Hawkesford Trustees Jersey Limited, and most recently 18 of Plevin, Judgment of Lord Sumption, there is a lengthy line of jurisprudence which is to the effect that an appeal is a separate proceeding from a trial, and as a result that an appeal must be treated as a sort of separate proceedings for the purposes of costs, even under a more broadly worded provision such as section 51 of the Senior Courts Act 1981. So in such circumstances, I mean, there may well be a very short answer in theory, that the court's order to remitting the issue of costs to the upper tribunal was out with its own jurisdiction, which, given that the Secretary of State in JH's primary, essentially sole argument is that this should be the approach taken by the administrative court in all CART judicial review claims. Indeed, they've amended their pro forma letter. You may recall I read some of the previous version of this pro forma letter earlier in my talk. They've now amended that order to try and encourage the administrative court to take this approach in every single CART judicial review claim. The effects of these arguments, if they were accepted by the Court of Appeal, could well be very far reaching for this area of law. Thank you very much for listening. I think that's everything I want to say on CART judicial review claims, and thanks you for joining us this afternoon anyway for obviously, hopefully, some interesting talks.
Thank you so much. That was very interesting. I find it particularly, I don't do immigration judicial reviews, but your comments about the pre-action protocol procedure is relevant to all judicial reviews, and that was very interesting for everybody, I think. There's one question that has come up on the chat, which I wonder whether you could both have a think about. That's from Nicola McIntosh of McIntosh Law. And she says, is there any experience from practitioners about the circumstances in which the legal aid agency will exercise its discretion to pay pre-permission costs. And that would be where you don't get permission and the case then gets withdrawn, or you get permission refused, isn't it? Whether the legal aid agency has taken issue with payment of cost pre-permission where work has been done in relation to interim relief. I don't know whether either Martin or Paul has experience of dealing with that, or anyone else.
I don't have experience of it. I think the rule, in fact, is that you only get it if the court neither refuses nor grants permission and you withdraw. So I think if the court refuses, then that's an absolute bar. And your only opportunity then is to get costs from the other side if they were actually unreasonable or something, or to renew. And then, of course, the problem then happens if you renew and then settle, then the court has refused permission. And you can't even get costs from the LAA on that. But in terms of the principles, I'm afraid I don't know. I haven't got anything to add about what courts are, what the LAA is doing. Paul, I don't know if you've got any.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, the only time I'm dealing with interim relief is to try and prevent removals from occurring, obviously, as an immigration practitioner. Fortunately, I mean, generally, I generally get my interim relief, my injunction granted, and then it just normally gets rolled up in the remainder of the case. I've never probably been involved in a case where I've certainly been refused interim relief, but not in a legally aided case. I probably don't have anything particularly to add to what Martin's already said.
And of course, if you're claiming interim relief, then you step outside the no cost rule anyway, and then again there's another issue there about how far the LAA will distinguish between the interim relief part of the claim and the rest of the claim. But I don't know if any of the other participants have got experience of this.
Well, I've certainly had a claim where I achieved what we wanted in interim relief, and then the judge looked at the issue of permission before we managed to settle the case and refused permission on the basis that we had got what we wanted because they had made the decision, we were JRing their failure to make a decision, i.e. provide accommodation, and then the judge refused permission on that. And that meant that, according to Ian Hollings at the Legal Aid Agency, he said, oh dear, that stuffs you for costs because you're not going to be able to get costs from the legal agency, which I think you might be able to get for the interim relief, but not for the rest of it, because it wasn't a decision that had been withdrawn. We were challenging a decision not to provide accommodation. So it wasn't a withdrawal, which is one of the exceptions. Anyway, it's just to be honest. There's another question from Nicola about whether there's any further decisions around invitations to mediate or some other kind of ADR and JR. And I wanted also just to add a question from me about whether to get around the problem with the conflicting authorities on whether you get costs at the end of the case, whether anyone had used Part 36 offers when you were writing the pre-action correspondence and saying, well, you know, although we're challenging this and this and this, what we really want is, you know, a Care Act assessment or the provision of accommodation or this decision being withdrawn, and then you get around using the Part 36 to get around that. I wonder whether you had any thoughts on that.
Sorry, can you just say that last bit again? I was looking at Nicola's question, but
whether you had considered doing a Part 36 letter at the same time as your pre-action correspondence saying we will settle if you do X or Y, and then you get around sort of the problem of them doing something and then the court going, oh well, you know, you would have done it anyway because you've got a Part 36. So you then, you know what I mean, it's a sort of like if in that housing case where the council offered accommodation and then they said, oh, it's got nothing to do with the fact that we've got a full hearing coming up in 3 weeks. It's just purely by coincidence. But if you had a Part 36 offer that you would withdraw, on that basis whether you'd have additional protection?
Well, I suppose if you... there's no reason why you shouldn't do a Part 36, and I can see that that would then give you a potentially greater leverage, although I suppose the argument would still be available to the defendant that there's no causal relationship. I mean, one of the problems I always feel is present with Part 36 offers is that in a JR, you've got to be offering something. And if the tenant, if your Part 36 offer at the outset is do what we want you to do, then what's the compromise? But I can see that it depends on what the nature of your claim is, and if you're asking, say, for a reconsideration as opposed to a complete reversal, then you can sort of split the difference, as it were, in your Part 36 offer. But I don't see in principle why a Part 36 shouldn't result. If you beat it, then on the face of it, it's then for the defendant to show why they shouldn't pay the cost rather than the other way around. One thing that is interesting in all of these cases is how few of them are ones where Part 36 offers have been made at all, and it does seem to be a pretty underutilized tool. I think there's only one of them in the review I did where a Part 36 offer was made, and then it was by the Secretary of State on the appeal, not on the substantive claim at all. On Nicola's point about mediation, again, I don't think there's anything which has expressly dealt with the mediation, with refusal to agree to mediation or unreasonable conduct in relation to mediation being a reason to deny or reduce costs. Osman was a case where the court reduced costs because of unreasonable conduct in relation to offers, but it wasn't a mediation case. And I think in one of the other ones, which is, I think, in the paper but not in the slides, a case called Archer, the court approved Plymouth and Cowell, but not in relation to mediation. They just drawn it as a more general proposition about exhausting alternative ways of dealing with the issue. It was a case where someone wasn't awarded their costs when they protectively issued JR proceedings rather than taking advantage of the statutory power to make representations. And then they made those representations after they issued JR, and the revenue accepted those representations, so the whole thing became academic. And Cowell was discussed in argument in that, but not as I say, in the mediation context. And there may be other cases that haven't got to the report, or there's been no reported judgment which have dealt with mediation, but I'm not aware of any.
Thank you for that. Has anyone got any questions? I think there's a way you can put your hand up if you can't access the chat. Oh, there's a question here from Antoinette Charles. Has there been any successful challenge to a no order for costs order where the parties have not settled and the respondent has shown some compromise, following the principle 3 of R. B. Croydon, and guidance on how to tactically challenge such an order where the claimant has substantially obtained all that she or he wanted and not awarded costs due to the defendant's claim of compromise, respondent's claim of compromise. Neither of you two answer that. Can you see the question?
Yeah, I can see it. So, Antoine, I don't know if you want to unmute on this, because is what you're asking about.
Right, so we've had a judicial review claim where the claimant had removal directions. This is just the basic background of the case. He issued a PAP perhaps 2 days before the claim was issued, and of course he was being removed, so the respondent didn't have time to respond to the claim, to the PAP. And of course, whilst the removal was stopped, the whole issue kind of took a turn in terms of trafficking. He claimed to be trafficked. Initially, there was a negative initial decision on the trafficking issue, but later on, a positive decision was then issued. So the respondent at the time decided that they would review the fresh claim in terms of the trafficking issue, but then refused to agree on costs. The judge agreed with the Home Office in the sense that the Secretary of State saying that there was a compromise, because although they're saying that they are going to review the decisions, it's a compromise, and therefore they would no cost. So we're finding ourselves now going through the whole system of trying to get permission. With this, and so I just wondered if perhaps there's any tactical guidance on the issue, because we've also got a
sorry, I think you've got cut off there. I mean, if you can still hear, it sounds like what's happened is that it's more a case one in Croydon rather than, or at least two, in that you've achieved a reconsideration, which is what you wanted. It's simply that the respondent seems to be saying they would have done it anyway. And it's, so it sounds like you're somewhat in Parveen territory, where the task is to demonstrate succinctly to the court that it was your proceedings that achieved that compromise, rather than the respondent saying they have done it anyway. And it sounds very much from what you're saying that the history suggests that the respondent was digging their heels in on the trafficking point and only came round once you'd issued. There may be a separate point about whether they had enough time to respond to the pre-action protocol letter, but when that is also a matter of substance rather than technical form. And the fact is, although you didn't need much time, they did have time. And in DPK, which is one of the cases in the slides, the court says that you should take a view on that as a matter of substance, that the question is whether the spirit of the pre-action protocol was complied with. And then there's also a Privy Council case called Singh, which I didn't put in the notes because it deals with specific judicial review rules in Trinidad where the procedure is different, but there is still a pre-action protocol process. And there, again, Privy Council says you should take a practical approach and not take too technical an approach when you're deciding whether or not there's been compliance with the pre-action protocol. So, and if you do comply, then you should get your costs if you succeed in what you're asking for. So it's really a matter of demonstrating on the evidence that the proceedings caused the capitulation.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Increasingly we're seeing letters from, very cheeky letters from government legal departments in immigration cases where you've got removals, where the removal directions remain in place. Frequently you might have further submissions outstanding which the Secretary of State hasn't addressed. And then you have to apply for an injunction if it's, say, a charter flight, only then to receive the acknowledgement of service, where the GLD then formally accepts that there won't be any attempt to remove your client until the further submissions have been considered. But they frequently then go on to say, well, the case has now become academic and should just be dismissed and there should be no order for costs, when obviously, patently, obviously the claimant has, or the applicant in the upper tribunal has achieved the relief they were seeking. I mean, I think, Antoinette, in your case, I mean, it, as Martin, I think, was saying, I mean, this number of cases which obviously take this approach, I mean, ZN Afghanistan, the one I was referring to, obviously does as well. I mean, if within your pre-action protocol letter and then your detailed statement of grounds, you were saying our client, and particularly if there was obviously allegation of the trafficking claim was referred to in the, within the claim, I mean, you should be saying that on a broad brush basis, claimant and applicant is a successful party because removal has been stopped for at least one of the grounds obviously previously relied upon by the applicant, and taking the broad brush approach under Z and Afghanistan, that ought to be enough for them to be regarded as a successful party and for costs to follow the event.
It does seem that it's always worth, for defendants, it's always worth a bit of a try on, because you might get a judge that doesn't like claimant solicitors and then they won't order costs, and you're not really going to get very far with an appeal if it's pre-permission. But, you know, that's just me being cynical, possibly. Are there any other questions before, we're just at 4:30, so this session should be coming to an end now. But before we go, are there any other questions that anyone wants to make? Well, just then, thank you so much, Martin and Paul, for your incredibly interesting talks on this. It's an incredibly important area. Without obtaining inter-parties costs, it is impossible to do public law on a legal aid basis, particularly in London, but increasingly outside London. So it's something that is topmost in our minds always as claimant solicitors. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just want to say thank you on behalf of PLP to Polly for chairing the session, and to Paul and Martin. Thanks very much. And just to say, in reply to a few people who've asked, we will be sharing all the links and in an email with all participants, and we'll be publishing this talk anyway with the relevant links. Thank you very much, everybody, for attending.
Thank you.
Thank you.